I'm going to begin with one of my favorite shmuzim. For those of you that may have been in camp, I said the shmuzim in camp. The purpose here is not to say a shmuz. I feel a little guilty tonight. I never wanted to compete against Seder, so I never give. I don't think what I have to say would be Docha Seder. So that's why I always gave the Vod after the 10:30 Marav. At 10:30 Marav, everyone's off. You're on vacation. So if you want to come to me, it's all icing. But now already is like a shtickel during Seder. Someone asked me, and I'm not the etzem against it, but I told him to ask one of the Rebbeim. So he said that it's okay. So I feel I should start off with one vart. Okay, I'm not saying the shmooze for the purpose of a shmooze, so you can't hack me on it. But if you want to, you could, but not now. It's for the point of the shmooze. And the shmooze, at the beginning of Shoftim, it says, Shotrim v'shotrim, tasim l'fanecha. You have to make a shofet and a shoter. Shofet is a judge, and a shoter is an officer. So the Medrash says, and there are like a lot of different pshatim, why the juxtaposition of shofet and shoter, why they're next to each other. A lot of different drushes on that. So the Medrash says, shofet has to be like the shoter, and the shoter has to be like the shofet. Like what? Just like the shofet. Has to be a Adam Gadol, Tam Chacham, Yeri Shemayim, Baal Midas, Tzadik Gomer, a shofet? Be a Dayan? Who's going to be a Dayan on the Bezin HaGadol? Who do you think? On the Sanhedrin. The people saying the Sanhedrin would be the best. So too, the shoter has to be a Tzadik, a Yeri Shemayim, a Tam Chacham, a Baal Musar, a Gon. So to the shoter. So the obvious question is, Bishlama, the shofet, the judge, has to know how to pass an halacha. He has to not have negiyas. He has to be a Yerei Shemayim. He can't take bribes. He has to be a Tzadik Yisod Olam. But even the Supreme Court, they judge if they had a... If you were trying to get into the Supreme Court and you like had... You were ever pulled over for a DUI or a suspended license because you didn't pay your ticket, oh my gosh, you're out. I have a Talmud from my yeshiva. I'll tell you who it is. I won't say who it is. All right, whatever. I still learn with him. You see him around. I can learn with him still. So I have this Talmud. He works for the federal government, FBI, and he has the highest level security in the country. So if the president want to pick him to be in his cabinet, he would need no security clearance. In order to get that security clearance, they went through rounds and rounds and rounds of tests and questions and lie detector tests. They hooked him up through there for 2 hours with these things, and they took his under blood pressure. The blood pressure cuff was going for almost two hours, he told me. He thought he was going to die. That's how much. And they were asking, pelting him with questions. He had to answer them quickly. You didn't have time to think. And they went through it. They grilled him, and they under duress, and they get you, and they keep asking you. They try and get you angry, and what you're going to say, and who needs it? They try to get you angry, and they try and do all that. He passed this test. I told him I would not have passed the test. And they try to see if you have any biases, anything, and he passed. So that's just to get to the Sanhedrin, to the secular court. You can imagine a Sanhedrin. Now, a shoter, what does a shoter do? The shoter is the one who gives malchus. Okay, anyone who went and learned Maseches Malchus knows that you stand on top, and the mukah stands below, a little below you. He's not even facing you, and you're hitting him. And the Medrash says that the shoter needs to be a chacham v'novon, so that the mukah, the one who's getting hit, will take the musar when he witnesses the pain that the shoter feels that he performed this chait, that he did this sin. So first, the first diyuk is, if the shoter wouldn't be a chacham v'navan, then the mukah would not do tshuva. And as he's trying to get him to do tshuva, that's why he's giving him makas. So first thing you see is that the purpose of the malchus is not pure punishment. It's to get him to do tshuva. That's the purpose of the malchus. So that, therefore, one has to always analyze, you know, punishment, which we, it's a word we really don't use too much anymore. We say consequences, we don't say punishment. But anyway, even if it was a punishment, the whole punishment is supposed to be a deterrent. Not that other people will see, like everyone wants to say. It's the person himself, by giving him that punishment, it's going to get him to do tshuva. I question nowadays, you know, you tell a guy, the average guy, you're going to give him a punishment, and you give him malchus. Okay? Well, you can't not hit a kid anymore because you get in jail. So let's say you're going to hit him with, fine him, you're going to knas him. So the first kasha on a knas is this. The whole idea of punishment is going to get the person to tshuva. Okay, let's go into the minds of an average high school kid. Okay, you go to him, you say, okay, you came late to Minyan, or whatever, you, let's take a good one. You looked out the window. Don't be like that one. You looked out the window. It wasn't during your time anymore, right? But you heard about it. They used to give a knas if you looked out. Oh, in your time?
I think it was no crazy.
So they got rid of it. Yeah, I hacked them. So you give a knas. Okay, well, what's the average high school kid going to be thinking when you give that knas? Oh, man, I better do tshuva. Okay, you know what they're thinking? They're a bunch of... You know, what do they think they are? Telling you what to do, trying to control my life. You know. So that's the first vart. Okay? Make a diak. So if he wouldn't be, if the shote would not be a chachmanov and the muka would not do tshuva, that's pretty fascinating. That if he wouldn't be a chachmanov and he would not do tshuva. Okay? That's very important. So what about this shote is going to make him do tshuva? How is that going to happen? Why won't the malchus itself? Like, who cares? The shoter, the stronger he is, the bigger bulvani is, you think he'd do a better job hitting him. So why wouldn't the malchus itself do tshuva? So Teretz is, I'm assuming, this, you're welcome to debate it, you know, if you want to hack, but just my own way of thinking is that the malchus itself not going to get him to do tshuva because next time he'll be careful not to get caught. It's not going to happen again. Ma'aseh b'chol yom. You get caught speeding, you get this big ticket, you're good for a little bit, you know, but then right away, you know, you're speeding again. Why is he speeding again? Be careful, I'll look around. Last time I was so stupid, I should have seen that cop. I'm such an idiot, you know. What did someone just tell me? They got pulled over. Who just told me this? They got pulled over by a cop. He went through a stop sign. The cop pulled him over and said, sir, didn't you see the stop sign? He said, I saw the stop sign, but I didn't see you. So the average person, you know, I can't believe I went through. I didn't see that thing. I know myself. I got a ticket driving to Cleveland once for Gratko's wedding from camp. I got a ticket. And, like, I'm so stupid. The cop was sitting right there. That's what I'm thinking. I'm not thinking I'm so stupid. I was speeding. So stupid, I should have seen the cop. So that's not going to work. Bez is not going to catch me. So, Taka, how is the muka going to take the musr? First of all, most people don't take musr from the person administering the musr. The disciplinarian is usually the most hated person in the whole school. That's usually. So the answer is, it's in the words of the Medrash, is that because when the muka sees the pain on the shoter, it's the pain of that shoter that he senses. When he feels that pain,
you see it.
Okay, right, that it's communicated through the, I guess maybe the fact that he knows he's a chacham menavon, and he knows he's a tzaddik, he knows Rav Moshe Feinstein, he knows, he's seen him, and he knows it's, he's crying. He can feel he's crying when he has to do it. It pains him. So somehow that's going to cause the pain. So this is a very important concept. We hack on this point, the shmooze, but it's milk around, but it's such an important point that it's how he sees the bakasha, but the medrash is not disputable. It says it, that when he sees the pain of the shoter, that's going to get him to do tshuva. So that's a few things that's worthy to stop on. Okay, that's what makes it. The person do tshuva is when he feels the pain of the person giving him the malchus. So this is kedai to go back to an aleph beis vart. I take a lot of things for granted. Matan asked me, how can I didn't give a workshop on this? But I take most of the things I know for granted. So if I sit down, I feel like I'm squeezing it out of, you know, my head. This is the vart. So I heard from Rabbi Feuerman, but that wasn't his vart, but he told it to me so many times. There's an old vart. It's an algebraic equation that is true internationally, universally. It's true in all systems, all organizations, all households, all everything. Rules minus relationships equals rebellion. It's true all over. It's algebra. It's an algebraic equation. Rules minus relationships equals rebellion. So if he would walk into a school and he sees rebellion, so the first time he came to us, I think it was 2001, the school year 2001-2002, and I called him up. I never heard of him. I mean, I heard of him, of course, but I had no relationship with him. I called him up blind, and he was coming down for a Torah Masorah convention in January, and he said he'll save us a little money because his trip is already paid for, so he'll come in. I mean, the extra day we were going to pay for, but all the expenses of the hotel and everything was already paid for. He'll spend one day in the yeshiva. And I asked him to come because there was a lot of vandalism going on. There was a tremendous amount of chutzpah. And one 10th grader like ripped up a teacher's test paper in front of him. That's what I think of your test. And he ripped it up and threw it out. It was like over the top. And then one guy, what happened? A guy came over to me on a Sunday morning and asked if he could leave early today at 11:30. And there's a family outing. And I told him, you can't go tailgating at a Dolphin game. That was my response to him. And besides, that day we had a speaker on a Sunday. It was a speaker. I don't remember why. It must have been like a Sarah Simichu, something like that. We had a speaker. And like halfway through the speech at 12:15, he just got up to go to the bathroom and never came back. So he left. And then there were like five incidents happened. I wrote to Rabbi Feuerman, five incidents happened. And I said, and the reason why I'm writing to you is that maybe not so unusual, but they all happened on the same day. In different classes, it was all around. So like, to me, that was like rock bottom. So he did not even need to come to the school. He was able to give me a diagnosis over the phone. Having not even met anyone, he gave me a complete diagnosis over the phone. Rules minus relationship rebellion. So we have rebellion. What you have, he said, is a sure, unadulterated rebellion. That's rebellion. Okay, he can see worse rebellion, but when you see vandalism, you see a lot of chutzpah, disrespect, it's just, you know, teenagers don't know how to express themselves, and they express themselves in the form of rage, which comes out in often vandalism, a lot of showing of disrespect. It could result in cheating. It's like, you know, they can't say too many things in public, especially in front of the secular teachers. They don't like to hear that. But cheating is a form of disrespect. And I did, when we had our meeting last week before school, the subject of cheating came up. There was a lot of plagiarism going on last year in the high school. I was not involved in that high school that point last year, but there was a lot of cheating and plagiarism. And I kept saying that the studies show, it's right there, you can look it up, Google it, that the you know, surveys, when they surveyed a lot of students to say what's the reason why they feel that's justified to teach when they feel they're honest people, And the reasons they give is that the teacher was unfair, they did not teach the material properly, they're not testing accurately, you know, didn't prepare them properly. So all those signs are signs of disrespect.
How did the teacher?
And how did the, what?
How did they take that?
You know, I made a lot of comments now, but I'm coming, it's easy for me to say them now because I'm just saying it like I'm taking it from the Luftwasser, coming from the wind. If I would be around another 6 months and I said it, they would be really disrespected because they think I'm attacking them. Right now they said, yeah, he's just quoting the books. You know, it's not yeah, us, of course, quoting the books. So they took it okay from me. I don't know, 6 months, I probably wouldn't say it. But, you know, and this is a very, very important yesod. It's a yesod that when you have rebellion, so now what do? How do you fix rebellion? So rules, it's algebra. So if you on the right side of the equation is rebellion. So you know algebra. If you want to decrease rebellion on the right, you have to decrease something on the left. So no problem. You can either decrease the rules, or you could increase the relationships. And this is a good point time to just hone in on a Covey principle. Which is, if you never read it, the first time I heard about it, I was like so fascinated by it, I was riveted. I almost didn't go into yeshiva. I was just, you know, when all this was going on, someone introduced me to the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, and I heard the book, but I never read it. And I was introduced to the chapter 6, I think that was chapter 11, I don't know which one, on relationships. It's a must read. Just, if you just get your hands on the book and just read this chapter, it's Kedai. And it talks about the emotional bank account. And it's probably been popularized already. You've probably heard it, but I'll just say it over quickly in just a couple sentences. That, and I'm dealing with this right now because I was thrown back into the high school. So I'm dealing with all of the 10th, 11th, and 12th graders. The 9th graders are fine. They don't know who I am. So they wouldn't know who anyone was. That's easy. But 10th, 11th, 12th graders, you know, they know who I am. But I have no relationship with them, really. You know, they're giving a schmooze here and there. I dabbled with the 9th graders last year. So some of the 10th graders I know, it's a little bit easier. It's true. But the 11th, 12th graders know shachas too. And what do? You know, if you have to make a correction on something, you can't just let everything go. Some things have to be corrected. And I have no relationship with them. So Covey says that if you go to the bank and you make a withdrawal from your bank account, let's say you have $150 in your bank account, and you make a withdrawal of $160, overdrawn. Your account is overdrawn. So they charge you, and all sorts of penalties come up. Even if you have overdraft, sometimes they just close your account. You're done. Out of here. You know, you default on your account. So the same thing is true. So if you want to correct it, so what you're supposed to do is you make a lot of deposits. Deposit. Now you have a few hundred dollars. And then now you make a $150 deposit withdrawal. It's very good. No ramifications. No negative consequences. So you think about it like this. So if you have, you know, new students in the school, you must spend all your time on making emotional deposits. Good morning, how's it going? Anything you need, can I help you out? Have a meeting with them, have a meeting with groups, meet with the seniors, let me get in with them, how can I do for you? You know, the famous senior thing, you know, you probably guys are looking for a lounge. I don't know if I have a lounge, you could use my office. I'll give you my office for 15 minutes a week. You guys have your own meeting in my office, you know. You get in. You got to tackle the 11th graders. You know, on the first day, I had older Rebbeim like yelling at me, how you like this kid in the school? Look at his haircut. You know, how you like the kid in the school? So, okay, nobody wanted to go with him. I was stuck. I had to go with him. Uh-huh. That was very, very difficult. Very difficult. I had to make a withdrawal without any money in the bank. had nothing in the bank. I didn't even know his name.
Once you had a certain stature, you don't need.
You have a certain stature, you need more money in the bank.
Because
I'll explain to you, how would you feel if Rabbi Luban would come over to you one day and say, you know, when I hear you davening, you're mispronouncing a word. Or, okay, I'm sure you're just sadik nachem. You're probably gonna say, "Wow, the gadol Rabbi Luban came over to me himself. Can you imagine? And told me I mispronounced the word." Most people, the greater the person who's giving you the correction, the worse it feels. The Rashiva told me, that he doesn't give any criticism to the guys. Guys couldn't handle it from him. I'll tell you this, Maisa, I can't help it. It's not off topic, but it's on Menachem's question. So this is a true story. I was mamash in the story. The yeshiva, they should be blessed, Queens. It's my yeshiva. I love the yeshiva, but they're a little crazy. So they basement. Okay, so they added another bed in every room because they didn't have money. And they wanted to close down all the apartments that they had in Middle Village or Forest Gardens or whatever. So if they just add one bed to every room, then there'll be 9 more beds or 12 more beds, and they close down the apartment, save a lot of money. Except the rooms, which were too small for two, already had 6, and now they're adding a 7th. Okay, they weren't just adding a bunk bed, they were adding a 7th bed. I knew it, no bed. So like, it was crazy. It was like no room to walk in. So every room, people were livid. But yeah, okay, yeshiva put in. One guy was livid. The custodians came in one afternoon. You know, they hired a few people to put in these beds, you know. One guy went at night and took it apart. So I'm eating breakfast in the dining room, Forest Hills, and Rabbi Trapper, Zichrono Livracha, Tzadik Ayid, Rabbi Trapper. So he goes over to the guy. He says, you know, I understand that a bed was put into your room and you took it apart. It needs to be put back. So he says, okay, is somebody moving in? He says, that's not the question. You have to put it back. Is someone moving in? That's not the question. You have to put the bed back. Okay. I'm eating breakfast, eating my Rice Krispies. Next day, same routine. This is a close friend of mine. My trapper comes over and says, did you put the bed back? Is somebody moving in? That's not the issue. You have to put it back. Okay. Next day, my trapper comes over to my friend. Good morning. Did you put the bed back? Is someone moving in? This goes on for like 10 days. Every day, my trapper comes over. Did you put the bed back? Someone moving in? That's not the point. You have to put it back. After 10 days after my friend left, I know he was my close friend, and I want to throw him under the bus, but I couldn't take it anymore. I go to Ray Trapper. I said, I don't understand. He's my friend, but he took apart a bed that the Rosh Hashiva, put in. You told him to put it back, and he's not listening. What are you being so nice to him for? Ray Trapper says, you think I care whether the bed is there or not? He goes, you don't? He goes, no, I couldn't care less. He says, why do you ask him every day? He said, let me tell you what happens. Every day after Shacharis, there's a Hanhala meeting. So we all go to the meeting. Rashiva's there. Rashiva comes over to me and says, did he put the bed back? I said, I don't know. I'll ask him. So I go over and I ask him, did you put the bed back? And he says, did someone come? He goes, I don't know. You have to put the bed back. So every day, the Rashiva asks me. So every day, I ask him. If the Rashiva wouldn't ask me, I wouldn't ask him. Rashiva would do everything. Everyone thought like the Rabbi Trapper's Meshagas with the attendance. There was a Rashiva who wanted to know the attendance. Rashiva did not do anything himself. He did thing himself, but he wouldn't do any type of criticism himself. He said the guys couldn't handle it from him. So just to answer your question, it's a little digression that... Would it make a difference at a certain stature? No, it'd make it worse. The more stature you have to be careful, is make it worse, it'd not
more
better.
Compliance.
I don't know.
If Rashiv asked the guy to put the bed together.
Yeah, maybe initially, they get angrier quickly, more quickly. So I had one, my roommate, maybe something was wrong with him, down the cops' course, but every day he didn't get up for Shacharis, and he woke up like at 12:30, 1 o'clock. The room was dark. Okay, I got up. And finally, after a few months of this, I know he was depressed. He was a good guy, but he wasn't into yeshiva so much. And one day, he had a meeting with Rashiva. I was so jealous. He had a meeting with Rashiva. I was a young guy. I could never get to Rashiva. He came back into the room. I was there. He slammed the door, said a couple of expletives, and the Rashiva told him to leave the yeshiva. You're out. Don't leave the yeshiva. I wasn't at the meeting.
That's why he slammed the door. That came out.
I know, but I'm saying, okay, he was pretty angry. I mean, I don't think it would have been. He was pretty angry. But okay. So, okay. And let's get back on the subject. You're asking good, but I don't want to get off the subject. So yeah, it was very hard. I had to do it without any kind of relationship, so it was very hard. He took it very hard. It was very hard. I did everything I could, b'shas ma'isa, to try and, you know, to pad it, but I had no choice. Hey, you know, I made a joke and I said, "Hey, how you doing? It's not such a big deal, you know, it's such a big deal." And you know, everyone has to, you know, do it. It's hard. Yeah, it's terrible. I remember when I was just terrible. I tried everything. You know, I did make it a little bit better, but it's very hard. So you have to put deposits, constantly putting deposits in, because you don't know. And everyone could use. You should always make deposits. You know, if you're in the position where you have to make correction. Now, a few rules. Okay.
Why should I be constant and listen?
If you need to make withdrawal one day, you have to buy a car one day. So you got to make deposit. You have to get a car.
How do you do a deposit?
So you have to be a chacham. You have to keep cheshbon.
A lot of times you can feel like it's fake.
Okay. You have to can't be fake. Dale Carnegie writes in his book, and someone told me that Ray Harris said that flattery, it's chanifa. And this part, I'm not able to argue with Ray Harris, but I told the president, he didn't read this part. He couldn't have read this part. So he walks into a bank, Dale Carnegie, and he says, "I'm going to this bank. I'm going to make that teller, look at him, he's busy all day just handing out checks, taking checks. It's the most boring job in the world. He looks like a banker. You know, bankers don't smile. They're just like, you know, nothing. I'm going to make that guy feel good." So when he gets his turn, he goes there. He tells the guy, "Sir, that's got to be the nicest tie I have ever seen. Where did you get it?" And the guy starts talking about where he got it, and it makes him all happy. So his friends, right? So he felt like he made him feel so good. So his friends, he writes in the book, "My friends say to him, isn't that flattery? He's Bavurin's Rabbi Harris, this kasha. Isn't that just flattery? You're just like, you know, doing tricks to make people feel good, but you're just like using the, you're just like having a bet, see if you get the guy to smile? What does it mean?" So he said, "No. Isn't there something to try to make people happy? Isn't that a principle? You should try and make people happy. We should try and make everyone happy. We don't should live our lives for ourselves. Try and make people happy." So I think if it's disingenuous, of course that won't work. It has to be real. These are your talmidim. You have to care about them. Do you care about them? Why do you care about them? You're hired to care about them? I mean, you could say like, why should anyone care about anyone? Okay, because he went to be a marbitz Torah because he wants to help people. And if he, can you get a box of tissues, maybe people need to pee me. You want to help people, and you're his Talmud, and so he really cares about you. He loves you. You have to really do it. You can't just do it because when you have to yell at him, you have to do it lishma.
Is there an ethical if they have no actual appreciation for the shirt or for the tie? You're just saying just so you can show that I care for you. Is that anyway just to compliment them on that?
I mean, what are you going to tell your kid brother or sister, you know, does something, you know, comes home with the ugliest picture. You know, look what I made. You're going to say, wow, that's so beautiful. What did you make? Wow, that's so nice. Do you think it's so nice? If someone tell you it's Hanifa, what would you answer them? Not Hanifa. You'd say, I'm trying to make my little sister feel good. She worked very hard on it, and I really meant it, that, you know, for her age, whatever, she has an imagination. You're trying to find something valuable for, to make them feel good, because you care about them. You want them to feel good. They took pride in their work. You're trying to show them. So I think it's not, you know, if you're totally doing it for the disingenuous reasons, I can't say it's not possible, but, you know, we're dealing with people who are trying to be honest. So anyway, so this, there's one more principle I want to say with this rules minus relationship equal rebellion, is that you have to dehara certain things that are very important to share with me a couple of things. So you have to make deposits. Okay, now let's say you're at work. One day you'll be at work and you have a boss you don't like. Okay, you're angry at them. So you want to go in and say, you know, with all due respect, I'd like to take umbrage with some of the things that are going on around here. So now that's a withdrawal. Everyone agrees with withdrawal. But you have to know not all the withdrawals are the same amount. Okay, yeah, if Rabbi Levine goes over to a 10th grader in February after he had a chance to make some deposits, and he says, you know, you need to get to class, it's a withdrawal, it is, but let's call it a $5 withdrawal. But if a teacher is going to go into Rabbi Levine's office and say, okay, Rabbi Levine, I'd like to tell you a few things, you know, I've been watching how you, and I'd like to say a few things, you know, how I think you're ruining the school and I don't appreciate, that's not $5, okay? That could be $5,000. You better make sure you have that money in the bank. If you don't have that money in the bank, you are overdrawn. He told me that if you're going to the president of the board, he taught me this, if you go, you have some criticism to the president of the board, that's $10,000. It's $10,000 withdrawal. He told it to me. What do you mean for me? He told it to me. He told it to me. That costs more. You know, $10,000. A lot of things could depend. Yeah, you try and make a better way. But you have to know before you do things. Oh, yeah, just go over to the director of the camp and say, you know, it's this place is messed up. You know, fine. Someone's got to tell them, so I'm just going to tell them. So, you know, yeah, you could. You want to try and go over to Rabbi Pfeiffer and tell him how to run his camp? You could, you know. But you make a big, very big withdrawal. Do you have that money? And do you want to use it up? Do you want to use it up on that? So you have to think. Before you say it, you have to think. Now, sometimes you don't have a choice. I did not have a choice. I had everyone yelling at me. That how could you allow such a thing? It's how do you call it? Okay. They convinced me that it had to be done, and I was the only one that could do it, so I had to do it. But it was not pressured. Sometimes you're in a situation, you're stuck, and you have to do it. So, and that's how it is. You have to keep cheshbon of the deposits and withdrawals. So, okay. So another. You so to just bear in mind. So once we take it this concept, rules minus relationships equal rebellion. So it's easy to get rebellion. You could forecast it. Take a class, go into a classroom, and you want to make rebellion. Say, excuse me, you get up over there, and you get up. Switch seats. Put your seats in a row. One in a row over here. Okay, take out a piece of paper. Not yet, did I say yet? I didn't say yet. When I say so, take out a piece of paper. I get a rebellion in less than 60 seconds. I could get a rebellion. Okay?
Is that because of lack of respect?
Yeah, because rules minus relationship means lack of respect. You know, it's you could change it to rules minus respect equal rebellion. But minus relationships. You have a relationship with someone, so you see something over here from this vort that the okay, I don't know if there was a relationship, there's a certain respect to the shoter, that in itself was getting the person to change. Once you have the relationship, you could do almost anything. You could almost impose any rule. You know, it won't make a difference. The person will do anything for you. They'll go to bat for you, whatever you say. And you see, you know, you see at a certain point in the year, you see Talmidim and Rebbeim, especially the younger kids, that they're so in, the Rebbe can tell them anything. They're just, once there's a certain trust that's developed, they're, you know, the rules don't bother them. There's so much deposit in the bank that it can withstand the test of another rule.
Maybe by trust, trust means like a carrier or?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, no, like things are even hurt.
It's them. Relationship. Trust is it means relationship. That's what it means.
Does this apply to all kids?
You know, these are just basic human yisodo, so if they're human, it probably applies. They're human.
I can imagine that some kids, like, no matter what you tell them, like, they'll.
You know, there's immaturity, so you have to know. You know, I was really talking about a high school kid who's already a little more mature and understands.
And will mature.
And but yeah, I think it's true. It would be true all over.
How do you work with little kids? Like how it's worked with like.
No different. You have to be age appropriate. I just don't have the the shimush, the experience with younger kids. So I'm not giving examples. I get an example looking out the window to get a knas, but. If I was more of a primary school experience, I would give, you know, things of, you know, drawing and writing ABCs. I don't know.
Any normal kid that is told to do it and then no relationship with the person told to do it will rebel.
Sure.
Makes sense.
Sure. You look at households. You can see different parents. You know, I love going to shul. Sometimes you see fathers with their kids in shul. It's the best time you could analyze, see how they do it. You know, I was in shul once, the father comes, father's there, and the kid like walks in like by, you know, Melanie, the mother finally brought him to shul, and said, why'd you here? What took you so long? I want you sitting next, I want you to sit next to me in shul. Now daven. The kid, you know, he's davening and he's looking around and he's so like, amazed by his shul. There's like so much action going on, you know, Sefer Torah and people coming up and the crown he's enamored by and the people and the rav is there and the machitzas are fancy and the aron, he never saw an aron like that, and every time he looks up the father elbows him in the stomach, they're daven, you know, within 10 minutes the kid's got to get out of there. He says, you know, he's talking and he's fidgeting and he, you know, he starts saying, my ankle hurts and this, and he turns around, the father had enough, and then get out, go inside, take a break. The youth groups, the father kicked them out already after like 10 minutes, you know.
Does the father have an unlimited account with the son?
No, fathers have not at all, because there's a lot of stuff going on in house. Rabbi Rottenberg was here last week, so he said, how many wars, when you tell this kid to take out his Gemara, how many, spoke for a little kid, you know, younger kid, how many wars has this kid gone through? He wakes up in the morning, say a younger kid, you know, not bar mitzvah yet, he wake up, his wake up, and he got into a fight with his mother or his sister or his brother. And then he got into a fight over breakfast, what he's having for breakfast. Well, then he got a fight over what he's going to wear, he doesn't like what he's wearing, he doesn't like that shirt, I don't like that shoes. Why I don't wear those? That says those are dirty. Those shoes are dirty. You said you're giving me new shoes. Why can't we get new shoes? You know, I'm not wearing those shoes. You know, these socks have holes in them. I get this kid to the kitchen table. It's already like five wars. And then, why can't I have that cereal? Oh, Shlomi finished it. Why does he get to finish the cereal? You know, he always finishes the cereal. I want to have that cereal. Now I'm not eating breakfast. You know, what do you make me for lunch? Make you peanut butter. I told you I don't want peanut butter. So you think the parent has, oh, plenty of deposits in there. Oh my gosh. One parent told me tonight on the phone that my son loves everyone except us, the mother and father. loves everyone except us. He hates us. He doesn't like us. He hates us. I feel so bad. He loves this Rebbe, and he loves his brothers, and he loves this and everyone in his life, but us. So they feel like they're at their wit's end. So I don't know. I don't think it's so simple. A kid to love his parents and to endless amounts of deposits. Not true at all. So there's a lot of withdrawals in the house. So lots of withdrawals. Tons of withdrawals. It's one house is withdrawal. Is withdrawal center. You want to get deposits, you got to take the kid out of the house.
Because they doesn't see the deposits out there, not there.
Well, of course they're there, right? But they don't see it, right? They don't feel it. They don't feel it. One day, when they're a parent, they'll realize that, oh my gosh, when the kid's up all night for a year, then the parent says, hey, wait a second. I was probably the same way, because I was also crying. Who stayed up with me? Oh yeah, your parents did that for you. They should have said that. You should have let you cry. You're not feeling well? Tough. You're not going to die. I don't have to fix anything. And you have a rash? They go away after a month. You know, and clothes? You don't like that clothes? They're tough. Wear them anyway. I'm not going to get anything. You want to walk out? You want to walk out with nothing? Walk out with nothing. You want to stay inside? Stay inside. I mean, you hear crazy abuse stories that happens.
Does that work?
But doesn't sound too good. Doesn't sound too good. You know, elu ve'elu. There's a range of normal, and then there's a range of jail and institutionalized. But it's tough. Yeah, there are some parents who do that. But you know, if he felt that he was cared for his physical things, at some point he's going to realize, hey, wow. Somebody did that for me. That's why you appreciate your parents after you yourself have children. Then you appreciate your parents more because you realize, hey, they must have done that for me. Wow, it's remarkable when you realize that. So, okay, it's very hard. Most kids don't appreciate that when they're younger. They do not appreciate their parents. That's why it's a tremendous mitzvah. Keep it up, aim. It's a tremendous mitzvah. It's not so easy to keep it over him, you know. Okay, there's some kids who are extremely appreciative, but okay, they're blessed with Amida, but it's not your typical thing. Just to hear that someone stayed up with you while you were crying and screaming, you know, and not even that you didn't deserve it. Even when you deserve it, you know, certain things you needed that also hard, you know. Childbirth is hard. You know, so like, okay, nothing you did, you didn't cause the pain, but the maisa. So, we had in 2000, I wrote my notes over here, in 2000, this was 18 years ago, so the yeshiva had, I haven't spoken about this in a long time, we had a very elaborate system to monitor dress code and davening. It was brilliant. And it was implemented in Rabbi Grumblatt's time, which sort of, anything Rabbi Grumblatt did was like considered kosher. You could not not love Rabbi Grumblatt. He just always could only love him. So he got away with a lot of stuff that, you know, normal people could not get away with. So, and he was also brilliant. I remember we used to be on a Shabbaton and we used to play Tanakh baseball, Gemara baseball. You basically get it. You know, you ask a question and you get it right. You get on a first. You want a single or a double. Where Grumblatt, you could ask for a single, double, triple, or home run. And he was able to pull out of his head a single question, a double question, a triple question, and a home run question. And the level of severity, of difficulty on the question was calibrated exactly for a triple. We all had to figure out, it was just so fun to just have him say it. He was just one big barrel of laughs. But anyway, so we implemented this system that if you came late, it was 1 point. If you came very late, it was 2 points. And if you were absent, it was 3 points. And if you had your shirt untucked, it was 1 point. If you're missing a jacket, it was 1 point. If you're missing a hat, it's 1 point. If you were talking, it's 1 point. If you were sleeping, it was 1 point. You had to, sleeping was 2 points, and your head down was 1 point. And Rebbe had to figure out whether that was asleep or put a head down. But we was also very pot. This is like a little education is very dangerous. We also had positive reinforcement. You could also reduce the amount of points you had. If you davened for the Amud, it was 3 point deduction. If you had a clean any 6 days or any 5 days in a row without any points, is minus 10. And if you want to stay for an hour of detention, it's also minus 10. So it was self-monitored. Everybody had a code, and they posted up every day what your system was, what your points total was, and self-monitor. If you hit 20 points, it's automatic suspension. No questions asked. And if you get close, down for the Amud, or go 5-6 days, you see you getting close, it's 5-6 days, no points, and you're good to go. It was brilliant. But it was a disaster. If you would wake a kid up in those days, in the middle of the night, and say, Taurus Chaim, they would say, point system. That's how it took over the lives. That was the whole school. And I remember, Rabbi Freudman, I'm trying to explain to him. I remember explaining to him what the system was. He was like there with his jaw dropped. Like this is like a horror movie for him. It was a horror movie. Like he couldn't believe it. He's like pinching his cheek to see if it was real. Like, are really people so stupid that they do this?
Is there a good lesson
here? Why is it so bad?
It wasn't his idea. It was everyone trying to improve the system.
Why is it so bad?
You know, Be'etzem, it was teaching the boys, these are the rules. We didn't make the rules. The rules were there, sent to them. We have the same rules now. Nothing changed. And there was an easy way to monitor it. And, E with the Afsa and Afshe, if you don't do what you got to do, so that's, you got a point. There was no monetary knas. And just deal with it. It seemed, that wasn't so terrible, but the boys couldn't handle it. It was viewed as, very punishment oriented. We had these detentions going on because people got too close to wait till they did a Sunday detention. And we had our higher base manager guy, the routine, higher base manager guy sit in the room. And one parent came to pick up his kid at 2 o'clock on Sunday. And I was in the old building. And he said, I was in the office or in the dining room. He said, Rabbi Plotkin, can you come with me for a second? I said, yeah, where are you going? I want to show you something. See that? That's where my son is in detention. There were like 18 kids in detention. And the base manager guy there with his headphones, couldn't care about anything because he's getting paid. He didn't care what they were doing in there. They just couldn't leave. That's all. That was the only rule we had. And he says, see my son? Yes, I said, look in that room over there. And they were climbing the walls. These kids were climbing the walls in that room. And he says, you mean to tell me that my son is being rehabilitated in there? Yeah, he's even climbing the walls. I said, yeah, it looks pretty bad. So,
rewards, by the way, that would be better?
Rewards are... Here, I have this word. Giving a reward for something you are intrinsically motivated to do decreases the intrinsic motivation. Giving a reward for something you are not intrinsically motivated to do increases the intrinsic motivation. So, theoretically, if this you're not intrinsically motivated, learning is considered an intrinsically motivated thing. A person is not motivated to do something, okay, what are you going to do? You tell a kid who has no interest to do anything, no interest to go learn. So, okay, he has no interest. There's no intrinsic motivation. So, yeah, a reward, giving a reward, will slowly increase it unless you go overboard. But the worst thing, one of the Rebbeim told me, that the father and son, Avos Habanim, they have in yeshiva, is the worst thing ever invented in the history of mankind. Because he could take this first grader who cannot wait to go learn with Tati and go learn with Abba to go learn. And you take him there, and then he was ready to go learn. And then they stop the learning, and they tell you, look at this big prize you're going to get if you pick out your raffle ticket. And they pick the raffle ticket, you lose. Another losing night. So he goes home. What a wasted Abba Subbanam. I didn't win the prize. You know, and you do this week after week, and he just wins the prize, and there are kids who say, I didn't win the prizes. He doesn't want to come. He doesn't want anyone to go anymore. So what do? They came up with a system for that. Because every 3 or 4 weeks, that now you want to know why they do it. Every 3 or 4 weeks, they give out prizes to everyone. They get this little thing, like a little tchotchke they give out. Everyone gets a prize tonight. Why do they do that? Because all the losers that are over there, for 3 weeks, they give them a prize. So they get a prize. It's the worst thing. These kids are ready to go learn from the youngest age with their fathers just to learn. They don't need anything else. Just the time and the learning is worth it much by itself. Once you give out these prizes, and they fight. Oh my God, there were such fights about these prizes. We almost were considering not even letting them do it in yeshiva. We were so against it, but you know we just.
What would yeshiva do if they wanted to?
I don't know.
They wanted
a
program. What would they do?
We would have them learn. Fathers don't learn, and we give
out. You wouldn't even put out prizes.
You know,
many kids that are not coming in.
A lot of kids don't.
I'll tell you a ma'isa shaya, but you know, don't give out all the secrets. We used to have when you were in high school. You were in high school also. There used to be a thing that if you come to Shabbos Minyan, hey, your father ran it. You know, X amount of times in a semester, you get an exemption from the Parsha midterm and the Parsha final, midterms and finals. Okay, why do we do that? Because why would anyone kind of come to Yeshiva on Shabbos for a minyan? Number one. Number two, if we don't do that, then they won't come, and then they're going to end up going to what we found is either not going to shul, or they're going to be hanging out in the back of Young Israel with all the socializing goes on. So we created this minyan so that they'll be in a good Sviva and create some hergel of good things. That's how we did it. And you know, we did it after 15 years. We totally went cold turkey. We said, you know something, we're crazy. This is the best minyan in town. And when I'm going to expose myself a little bit. When my glazer was running, it was even better because it was 10 minutes faster. Your father was very much faster than Ray Dreyfus. So... Right, and I assume nothing changed. If anything, he got faster. Right, he doesn't, you know, fetch at all during davening. So that the minyan started at 9 o'clock. I don't believe they ever finished a second past 10:30, or there would be malchus. Okay, it was the best minyan in town. 9 and 10:30, and okay, now it's 9:10:40. It's basically the same thing. You get a hot kiddush with cholent and cake and soda. All your friends. The Rebbeim don't bother you about anything on Shabbos morning. They're just there. You go learn with your Rebbe if you want, have a good time with your friends, and you walk home. You don't have to sit with your father in shul. It's the best thing. We looked at each other once at one day meeting about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. We said, we must be crazy. Why are we giving out anything for this minyan? You know something? You don't want to come? So don't come. So the next year, we said... We said, you know, there's no more minyan, there's no more test. We got rid of the whole test. There's no more parsha midterm. Okay. Now, by the way, secret: there never used to be a parsha midterm. We only made the parsha midterm so that we could give an exemption. I wasn't going to give an exemption to a real test, so we made the Parsha test. Okay, and then because we realized that it was so stupid. Why are we giving out anything? Let them come. They want to come. You know something? After we changed it, I think more people come now than ever used to come. More people come.
We're trying,
and then more kids are coming now than came when we had the exemption.
That's awesome.
Huh? But not for the Shabbos Minyan. The Shabbos Minyan is totally... Huh? The Shabbos Minyan has no Shabbos, no attendance taken, nothing. Done. I think this is the second year. We got rid of that.
You don't mean for that. It's not because they had to take cards with them. They no chance of ever getting an exemption.
Why? They got credit for the minion.
Even though. Yeah.
Yeah. We gave them credit for the minion.
No, I don't know. They never got credit for
the minion. Huh?
We
had to come up with people outside of my North Miami Beach. If they went to shul, we had to come up with some, you know, crazy plan. If you go learn with the rabbi, you go to shashas. We made up all these crazy things with them. We didn't know what we were doing. We just yeah, that counts. That does count. That doesn't count. Bring me a note from the cleaning lady that you did it. We'll let you count. We didn't know what we were doing. But so it took us so many years, a decade and a half, to figure out, like, we were holding all the cards. We ruined it. The kids would have been glad to come for the right reason. Come daven. Come daven yeshiva. It'll be so beautiful. And I don't know why we didn't think of it. We just didn't think of it. So that's what, you know, you grow up and you realize you do something for the right reason, and it's so much more beautiful. That's intrinsically motivated. When they're doing it for the right reasons, much better. They come to yeshiva because they want to daven there. And now we tell the parents, now you don't have to come. Your kid doesn't have to come. If you want to daven with them, let them daven with you. If he wants to come, he can come. He's, you know, we got in trouble the other way. Right? But Larry Phil once called me to a meeting. It's not right that kids are being taken away from their, what do you tell me? Your kids are being taken away from their fathers, from young Israel. And if they don't come to yeshiva, I heard they're being punished. You make them take a test. I said, no, it's not really that. It's just that it's that there is a test. They can get out of it. I'm fumbling around. In the end of the day, that's how they viewed it. That you're being punished if you don't come to the yeshiva. You're being punished. You have to take a test. You know, I couldn't clear it any other way.
Is that issue still an issue that people are not going to show and socializing?
You know, it's sad, but kids don't have to go to shul now to socialize. When I socialize, you can find them much better than in shul. So you have a smartphone, you can do much better than, you know, the back of the young Israel. So do it by cover the on WhatsApp, you know. So you don't need the shul to. To have to socialize. So that really became a non-issue. Oh, Baruch Hashem. Smartphones. To protect the Kedusha Shabbos, you know, shul. So, but I think that it became less of an issue. But, you know, you look around. I was hearing tonight that Shari, which is a pretty, you know, mainstream shul, so I just found out tonight that they have before and after Plag, Mincha and Marv. Plaga Mincha. They're davening at 6:04, Minchas at 5 to 6, and they daven Marv at 6:06. Today, they were Minchas at 6:06. So, like, oh my gosh. I mean, the Sephardim always did that, but the Ashkenazim, the regular shuls, you know, halachically, you're allowed to daven if we do it on Friday night. But the regular shuls up there, and why are they doing that? Because people don't go out to Marv anymore.
Really?
So they don't go out to Meyer. You go to, you can't get me a fine. Go to the college. You can't get a, you can't get a, you can't get a seat. But you go anywhere else, there's no one there. You know, there's barely a minion. You got the old timers are there. All the old men are there for Mincha Marv, and there's no one there.
The
coal's
really hot spot,
you
said?
They are gewaldic.
What? We adults now are.
People, I don't know, the adults, you know, the generation coming up, they don't go out there tomorrow. Now, I'm talking about the Bnei Torah. I'm talking about the non Bnei Torah there. Well, the Baal Batim is too hard. It is hard. You know, they got to come from work and they get home at 7 o'clock. The kids are screaming. They put them to sleep and they finally sit down at 10 to 9, 9 o'clock for the first time. They're sitting down for the first time that day. You know what kind of tzaddik he has to be to go out and go learn now? Got to learn, then go out and learn and go marav. 9:10, won't see his wife, won't see him, just go out and learn. The guy's a tzaddik gomer if he does that. Okay, you have to be really committed to do that. You have to be really, really committed to do that.